We're listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends, the number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism, broadcasting live from Florida's Sun Coast on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Don't forget, you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's the travel guy, Roy Lowy.
Well, I don't want to disappoint you, but this is not the travel guy, but it is a travel guy sitting in for Vacationing Roy Lowy. And today we're going to do something a little bit different, a little bit special. We're going to look at and listen to some very special people in the travel industry, and they are George Turner, Steve Schussler, Anne Martin, and Bora Oskok. These are four travel professionals who have, each in his or her own way, made a difference to the largest industry on the planet, the travel industry. So today we're going to focus on public relations, communications, and role models in the travel industry. Roy and I recently had the opportunity to chat with each of these special travel professionals, and here's what they told us. Daytona Beach, Florida. In our ongoing series, Rediscovering America, Travel Traders Close to Home, I'll tell you what, I found one of them. It's called Daytona Beach, a community of communities, a very energetic, avant-garde community and travel and tourism destination. And get this, it's an arts destination. And I had just completed a media trip here in Daytona, and I have lots of stories to tell you about, but I want to get to that later. I want to talk about something else just for a little bit. I want to talk about the travel industry as the largest on the planet and why the traveling public really needs to know how this all happens. The travel industry affects the global, national, regional, and local economies directly and in many different ways. But it's an industry that's made up of a vast number of highly trained, skilled, and I'm going to emphasize this, experienced professionals who make this industry what it is, very successful, and also very important to the planet we live on. For example, convention and visitors bureaus, travel suppliers of all kinds, even and especially local businesses, the restaurants, the cultural institutions. And by the way, Daytona Beach has some wonderful cultural institutions. But we also have a global network of public relations specialists. These are people who work in the travel industry, and they're essentially educators. Not all teachers are in classrooms. And our public relations colleagues are some of the best communicators that you'll find anywhere. And I'm sitting next to one of the best known in North America, and her name is Georgia Turner. Good morning, Georgia.
Good morning.
You've had a very early morning. How come?
Well, I had to take somebody to the airport at 5 o'clock this morning and then take some other people to breakfast, but I'm ready to go again. It's beautiful today.
You're a totally dedicated person. And you've been mother to us. You have been the organizer. You've kept us on schedule. But you've also given us a real insight into Daytona Beach. And this is what we as travel journalists really appreciate and really need. You're usually the first contact we have. And I want to ask you, how did you get into this business?
Well, I was a journalism major. I went to Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama, and had the opportunity to be a cooperative education student. And I got a job in public relations. No public relations background at that time, but I got into a health department job. And just saw that I liked the health department. But after I got out of school, I had to go back and work at a newspaper. And while I was at the newspaper, it was not very exciting. So I decided I got all these press releases and started doing a travel column for my newspaper. And through that, I got associated with an organization called the Alabama Mountain Lakes Association. It was a regional tourism association for my home area. And I just loved them. And there was a PR person there that I told him if he ever left, I wanted his job. So I moved to Atlanta to take a magazine job, and about 9 months after I was into the magazine job, the man from Alabama Mountain Lakes called me and said, I'm leaving. Do you want my job? And if you can believe this, I went in, and the woman that I interviewed with at that time said, I'm looking for a man for this job, because you have to move a lot of things, and you have to carry a lot of boxes and things and what your job would do. And I took off my suit coat and showed her my muscle. And I really did that. And I just said, I can do anything that any man can do. And had that job for several years until I met a man who eventually married, but he was moving to Daytona Beach, Florida, to go to school at an aeronautical university here, and that brought me to Daytona.
Very famous university here, too.
Exactly right, Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and that's what brought me to Daytona. And we didn't have any jobs at first. He worked at a sunglasses I worked at a sunglasses manufacturer, and he worked screwing bottle caps on at Hawaiian Tropic suntan lotion factory. So we just came, really, you know, left good careers and came to Daytona with nothing. So, and from there, I went to work with the Daytona Beach Convention and Visitors Bureau and loved what I did there.
These are all what I call transferable skills. You pick up, you go, you start again, and you have the initiative, but you also have a vision. And Georgia, a lot of people have told me about you, and this is the first time I've actually met you. But what they say, in essence, is Georgia is a person with vision. Where'd that come from?
I have two very, very strong grandmothers, and one of them taught me how to work because they were both widowed at a young age. One of them taught me how to work, and the other one taught me the love of travel. And they're just the two instrumental people in my life, and I won an award one time, and I thank both of them for both of those traits, because travel and work go together, as you know. You've got to love to work and work hard and work a lot in the travel industry. It's just a very busy industry, but it's so rewarding. Everything that we do, I feel right now I'm just on cloud nine after a successful media tour, because I showed you the place that I loved, and that's what it's all about.
Okay, so let's talk about travel and public relations. What do you think are the key skills? If someone wants to go into this business, what are the key skills you need to be in PR, and especially in the travel industry?
I think that you just really have to have organizational skills. When I was in the fourth grade, I took a course called Study Skills, and it taught me how to study and outline and, you know, do to-do list and all of this kind of thing. And that has helped me, I promise. It has helped me, and I've told the teacher that taught me that a million times how much it helped me, because you just have to be very organized. And details, the details are just unbelievable. These last couple of days, we've done some things that probably weren't even possible, but I've had a lot of help. People know, you know, telling people you're only going to be there for 15 minutes, and if somebody starts trying to stay for 16 minutes, you have to be the bad guy and say, come on, let's go, because this is only worth 15 minutes when we've got something else great to see. So there's a lot of that in my business. I have to be the bad guy sometimes, but that's okay.
But you're someone who really likes people.
I do, and I think it's a lot of fun. Everybody's got such a great story, and when you've got a good product like we do in Daytona Beach, it makes our jobs easy.
The company's called the Georgia Turner Group.
Right.
Tell me about that. How did that get started?
Well, after I worked with the Daytona Beach Convention and Visitors Bureau, I got a call that my company, you know, or my old organization in Alabama, wanted me to come back and be the director where I had been before, 6 years before. So I went up there, and while I was there, got associated with a man who owned a business that brought travel writers into the area. I'd worked with him in Daytona and worked with him in Alabama, and he was retiring, so he asked me if I wanted to buy his business, and I did, because it was my favorite part of what I did in my other two jobs before. And everybody always says, if you do what you like, you'll be successful. And that's what I wanted to do. I love working with travel writers. This is my 22nd year in this business, in the tourism business, and I've loved every minute of it.
And before I forget, I want to get into this. Give us a website for Georgia Turner Group.
It's just georgiaturnergroup.com.
That's easy enough.
You know.
talk to me about some of your clients. Who are some of the destinations you represent?
Well, Daytona Beach is my biggest client. I live in Ormond Beach, which is the northernmost part of Daytona, and we promote seven communities within the Daytona Beach area. Sevierville, Tennessee, which is in the Great Smoky Mountains. Southwest Louisiana, Lake Charles, Louisiana, where they have all the great food and culture and that kind of thing. Lots of different places in Alabama. A lot of the places where I worked are still my clients. North Alabama area, Alabama Mountain Lakes region. We do a lot within the state of Georgia. I have two wonderful women that work for me, one that's in Nashville, Tennessee, and the other one that's in Atlanta, Georgia, that we just, this is what we do, is media tours.
And for this radio show goes out all across the world to anyone who understands, speaks English. Can you, this is going to be a difficult question, but I want you to just talk to them a little bit about the American South. Why is it such a special place?
Well, I'm a little partial because I'm from Alabama. I've lived in, well, my name is Georgia, too, but I've lived in Georgia. And I'm now experiencing Florida for the last, off and on for the last 20 years. And I just really think that it's the personality and the personalities, the people that you meet, is really what makes the South. Everywhere that you go, my job's very easy because all I have to do is set up an appointment, find the person who is in charge of the attraction, and they do the work. They tell the story, and there's so many wonderful, wonderful people. There's a man named Neil Shipman that was with Looney's Tavern up in North Alabama that had this great story about how one of the counties in the state of Alabama tried to secede from the Confederacy. Just some really, really interesting stories like that, but it's all about the personality, and it's all about the people. Some of the friendliest people that you'll ever meet in the whole entire world that would take you into their home, take you into their lives, love to talk about themselves and what they do and show you their life.
An incredibly rich culture on all levels, history, obviously, and I'm not forgetting the food, and we've had some of the best food here, quite frankly. The term Southern hospitality has actually entered the English language, and it's a concept unto its own. What is Southern hospitality?
Again, I think it's that feeling of no matter who you are, no matter where you're from, that Southern people welcome you. And it's really a very genuine welcome. They make you feel at home. They make you feel like you're a part of their family or one of their friends. And it's a real thing. A lot of people say, oh, Georgia, I know, maybe that's just you, and you're like that. But it's not. And it's scary to some people. Because when you're walking down the street in Montgomery, Alabama, people stop and say hello to you. And if you're from New York or from Budapest or wherever you are, you might not be used to that. But it's just a really wonderful thing. And you should, when you're in the South, you should get into the spirit and say hello back.
Sounds like grassroots public relations skills to me.
It is. It's really, I think some of the best PR people that I know are in the South. It's just because they're very welcoming.
So if people want to know more about what you do, it's georgiaturner.com. And I thank you for this. And I especially want to thank you for one of the best media trips I've been on in a long time.
Thank you. And I just have really enjoyed getting to know you, and thank you for your support of the tourism industry.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
Well, first it was Jukebox Saturday Night, a warehouse full of 50s and 60s memorabilia. In 1994, the well-known Rainforest Cafe's concept became a reality. Now it's T-Rex, a family adventure in Kansas City, which will also open in downtown Orlando. And if that isn't enough, there's an Asian-themed restaurant complex, Ying and Yak, which debuts in Disney's Animal Kingdom July of 07. What a guy. It's a pleasure to welcome the man who started it all, Stephen Schussler, and he's originally from Far Rockaway, New York, would you believe? Good morning, Stephen.
How are you? Thank you so much for receiving us today.
It's a pleasure. I just was going through some of your background, and interestingly enough, I went to PS44 in the Rockaways.
Oh, my God. Wow, what a small world.
Yeah, would you believe that?
Well, growing up in Far Rockaway, New York is... it really prepared you for the future. I'll tell you that it was a very diverse place back then.
You're going to need to. I know we've got you on your cell phone, so you're going to need to speak up just a little bit. But because we want to go to this whole T-Rex concept, first of all, when I look at the menu, you all must have sat around there and had one heck of a time just laughing and putting menus and names together, because there's some really funny stuff on there.
We sure did. We spent an awful lot of time among a group of about 30 people deciding what names. We had contests. We even spoke with paleontologists to make certain that whenever possible there was an educational message associated with the food.
And a great menu it is. Give us a little background on how the T-Rex thing came about.
Well, dinosaurs have never really been exploited. When I grew up in New York, and we had a field trip and we went to a museum, I would come home thinking it was a boneyard. It was a place for uprooted dinosaur bones. They never had skin on them. They were never animatronic. They were never interactive and for fun entertaining. So we wanted to create something that was first educational and entertaining. Obviously, the food had to be off the charts and had to be great, because people come once for the wow factor, but they come back for good quality food and service. And I think we did a great job in choosing Landry's as a partner, because their whole pretext in being in the food business is to serve quality food and service.
Exactly. And then, of course, you've got a lot of experience from the rainforest franchises, and so I guess it was a fairly easy transition once you had the concept together, I would think.
Yes. Once we had the concept together, we've been in research and development for over 8 years on T-Rex, and the other concept you were talking about is actually called Yak and Yetis. Yak and Yetis, and Yak is, of course, an animal, and Yeti is the abominable snowman, and it's going to be opening up in Asia inside Animal Kingdom, Disney's Animal Kingdom. So we're really excited about that one as well. Both of these concepts we developed in Golden Valley, Minnesota, in our warehouses.
Now, it looks like you're actually going to open that before the T-Rex project. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. We'll open up that next July. Right. In Disney's Animal Kingdom, and then February of 2008, we'll actually open up T-Rex at Downtown Disney.
Now, give us a feeling for what the people can expect when they walk in the door at T-Rex.
Well, what they would expect is over-sensory experience, one that excites every one of your five senses, literally. First is obviously the visual, and it's just it's multiple colors, it's multi-layered, and it's a multi-thought process. We even have tens of thousands of dollars worth of fossils in the men's room and ladies' room, which is called T-Rex and She-Rex. Everything has been well thought out. The attention to detail is actually over the top.
Now, did you have to create these fossils, or how did you put all this together? I mean, obviously it wasn't just lying around in a corner store.
No, we had to actually buy fossils. There are people that work full time in Madagascar, in parts of Africa, in parts of Uruguay, Argentina, all over the world, just digging up fossils to sell to people like me that use them for educational and entertaining values. So we've spent an awful lot of research and time and money to develop the contacts to literally make ourselves known all over the world before we open, so that we can properly address the concerns of schools, students, and paleontologists. So we had to walk a fine line with what was acceptable to be unearthed, what had to be left alone, what countries we could bring them in from. A lot of work and a lot of time went into it.
Now, I'm sure that when you first opened T-Rex, and I would think you're hiding behind a rock there somewhere just to catch the expressions on the people's faces when they came in the door. Give us a feeling for what you saw when you first opened.
Well, for weeks before we opened, we would watch the butts of all the people that were lined up at the glass doors looking in.
Right.
And every day we'd have to wipe the fingerprints and the lip prints off the windows. So I got a great deal of pleasure watching and listening both before, during, and after. And we really listen closely to what our guests say. And we react very quickly to their concerns, if they have them. And I got to tell you, overwhelmingly, people were just flabbergasted by the fact that we had Build-A-Dino, which is produced by Build-A-Bear. It's the first time that's ever been done,
right.
Which is an incredible experience. The gig experience they enjoyed, the mine experience, they loved the food. And I think overwhelmingly most people said they'd come back not only for the experience but the quality of the food. So we're getting a kick out of it. And there are things that people recommended that we change in one way or another, whether it be too cool in one area or they would say it was too bright in another area or not bright enough. I mean, we react very, very fast. That's the whole idea of having an inclusive relationship with our guests.
You know, you're absolutely right. If one sits back and listens to their clients or customers, you do get a lot of input, and it's important because with all the planning that one puts into these things, there you can't possibly touch on everything. So that is very important, and of course with these theme things, there's a great amount of kids and the adults and ourselves. There's got to be a great amount of kid in you to be able to come up with these concepts. And so now let's just move, if we can, over to the Asian debut in Disney's Animal Kingdom, because that apparently is opening in, as you say, in 2007. And are you actually calling it Ying and Yak? I love that name.
No, it's actually going to be called Yak and Yetis. And Yak is an animal that lives in the Himalayas, and Yeti is a name for the abominable snowman.
Oh, okay.
And so the idea of Yak and Yeti is that it sounds cool. It's fun. There's also a very famous hotel called Yak and Yetis, which is in the Himalayas. And so we're calling it Yak and Yetis, and it's a 300-seat table service restaurant and a 200 QSR, which is quick service restaurant as well, next to one another in Disney's Animal Kingdom. We can't be any more excited about it. Disney just opened up I think it's a $1 billion ride. In Disney's Animal Kingdom, and our restaurant will be about 100 yards away from there.
And what kind of menu? I'm sure you haven't worked out all the details, but how are you leaning towards? Is it going to be Asian dishes? Will there be?
It will be Asian fusion, which will be a combination of American Asian food with actual Asian food, because we want to hit the masses. We want to make sure that the guests that go to Disney walk away with a very pleasurable dining experience, and as well as the Asian customers that come to Disney. So we really want to hit on all four cylinders, if I might say that, and make certain. So we're in test kitchens literally every week with our partners at Landry's Seafood Restaurants, and I should say Landry's Restaurants. Their experience in food with over 300 restaurants goes the whole gamut, from steak to fish to pizzas and salads. So we're going to add a lot of Asian dishes and make it an Asian fusion experience, but also we're going to have some American dishes you know, just in case somebody wants a hamburger and they're waiting in line at our Yak and Yeti's fast food service, we want to make certain that they don't come up and they don't see something that they like and have to go somewhere else. So
exactly.
It's a combination of different foods.
Now, the T-Rex is actually going to open in downtown Disney, is that correct?
Yes, sir. In downtown Disney, it's approximately 200 yards away from the Rainforest Cafe that we've created that's now 11 years old and still going strong.
That's absolutely super. Stephen, we thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us. It's an exciting life that you've been leading. As you say, it's not done yet. We're looking forward to the opening of these two restaurants, and maybe we can chat down the road a little bit with some updates on how things are going.
We're looking forward to it, and we're looking forward to your listeners being the first among the guests to eat there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. Bye for now.
This is the story of Mary and Larry. They had cabin fever so bad it was scary.
We need a vacation, a place warm and sunny, a place that's fun for not much money.
Let's escape the cold and the snow. We'll fly Sky Value from Gary, Chicago.
Sky Value now offers great rates from convenient Gary, Chicago Airport to your favorite hotspots, Orlando, St. Pete, Fort Lauderdale, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. Book your flight at flyskyvalue.com.
Gary, Chicago Airport works for me. The drive was easy.
The parking's secure and free.
Sky Value sure saved us money.
You're so smart.
And so is my honey.
And they flew Sky Value from Gary, Chicago Airport happily ever after. Fares are one-way, subject to availability and change. Restrictions apply. Fares do not include September 11 security fees and other U.S. taxes and fees. See participant agreement for details. Sky Value flights operated by Extra Airways, PC number 06154.
Well, we're back, and it's always a pleasure to welcome TV broadcaster and producer Ann Martin to the show. Nice to have you back, Ann.
Hi, Roy. Nice to be back.
Listen, since the last time we spoke, a lot has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you have completed your three-part series, Journeys Through the British Isles, which is airing where at the moment?
Well, it's airing on PBS at the moment, on WNED out of Buffalo. And soon I hope to be able to say where the other stations will be and what times. But it went a week ago, Sunday, I guess it was, for the premiere. And I was so thrilled, Roy. You know what it's like when you spend so much time on putting a production together and it goes well?
Absolutely.
But what you probably also know is that by the time you finish a production, you absolutely hate it. You think there's everything wrong with it. You wonder why you ever started it.
You hate yourself. You hate the way you look. You hate the way you sound.
You think I should take that shot out, and I wish I'd got that other shot, and I should have put that in.
Absolutely.
So you're always down on your work, but it really was very successful.
But
I'm
of course,
very happy.
That's the marvelous part about editing.
Yeah, well, that's the rewarding part.
Exactly.
You know? So it was really quite exciting. And the other lovely thing was I had so many phone calls from people after the fact telling me how much they had enjoyed it. And I think it was grand because not everybody is that watches a program like this necessarily has come from the country, but a lot of them have friends or relatives, or they're descended from people who came from different parts of Europe. And so there's always that kind of interest to see what the highlands and the islands look like, you know, in Scotland, for example, or parts of Wales. And the thing that astounded me was that the number of people that did not even know that the Isle of Man existed.
It's amazing, is it not?
It is, yeah. So in a way, I was kind of pleased that I was addressing some of these areas of lack of knowledge and maybe exciting people to go to that small island and learn all about their Manx heritage and the Vikings and the fact that they have their own language, their own currency, their own parliament. You know, it's kind of neat.
You have it broken down into three sections.
That's right.
England,
yes.
Wales, Scotland, and Island of Man, as you've just mentioned.
Right.
Then Ireland.
Ireland was the third episode, that's correct. And we actually called it the Emerald Isle because we wanted to be politically correct. And we didn't want to get into the fact that there are sort of two separate aspects to Ireland. So we wanted to do the whole country together. And I think it's worked well. And I think it's time. We want to bridge things, not sort of you know, get into the divisiveness that sort of occurs in so many countries today. We'd like to sort of build the bridges and have people look harmoniously at travel as a way of learning about people and cultures and enjoying their experiences. So we actually traveled the whole of Ireland, and I had two of my great friends also that did some of the filming for me there, and they took they enjoyed themselves, actually. It was quite frustrating. I think I was filming in England, and they were off cruising the Fermanagh Lakelands, which I thought was a bit unfair.
Now, in your opinion, what did you do differently in presenting this?
Well, I think what it was pulling the idea of the journeys together, because one of the frustrations when I first started tackling it, you can stand on a corner in any part of the British Isles, but let's just take a small corner in London, for example. You can stand there, and if you move one pace to the front of you, you've got a completely different story than if you move to the left, the right, or behind. There is so much history, there is so much information, and everything from the cultural aspects, whether it's food or language or whatever. And it becomes very, very complicated. And I started to think, well, can I go around the country and do it this way? And I realized I couldn't because of all the different time frames and things. So that's why we came up with the concept of journeys. And the journeys actually flow very nicely into each other. And I think that was the good thing, because I talked about, for example, we go into Jane Austen, following in the footsteps of Jane Austen. So that took us into Bath and Shaftesbury, and Stourhead and Chawton and Winchester Cathedral, where she ended her life and where she was buried. And then there was a nice little sort of a segue from that to other authors, and we then went to Charles Dickens, and we followed in the footsteps of Charles Dickens, which was a completely different kind of experience, going into Broadstairs and Rochester, where he wrote many of his books.
And you even did Harry Potter.
And we even did Harry Potter. And actually, I had a marvelous experience, because just before the series went to air, I spent a few weeks back in the British Isles, traveling around, doing a few things, combination of updating some information that I wanted, and also to see family and friends. And we took the train journey. We were going to go up to the Kyle of Lacalche, which is up at up in the north part of Scotland, out from Inverness. And we decided that, no, we would do the one that takes us out to Maleg, near the Isle of Skye. And we went over Glenfinnan Viaduct on the train going out there. And the viaduct was actually part and parcel of one of the Harry Potter films. So I think it was the one with the Philosopher's Stone, where he flies a car through the viaduct. And you can also see one of the steam trains that goes over the viaduct in one of the movies. So it was kind of interesting to even see that aspect of it, because when we did the story with Harry Potter, we were concentrating more on Glastonbury and Tintagel and the stories of Arthur and Merlin and how they kind of tied in with the Harry Potter concept.
And it sounds like good fun as well.
It was. The only thing that wasn't fun, well, it was, I suppose, in a way. The stories are great after the fact, but when we were hiking through the Highlands and Islands, we went over to the island of Mull, and we were walking through an area, and we had really set ourselves quite a long trek, and we were determined to do it. But what I didn't realize was the size of the boulders sometimes can be extremely difficult to manage to get around and over. And then we'd suddenly find ourselves in a bog, and it's almost like standing on that sphagnum moss, and you feel yourself sinking, and you're not really sure whether you're ever going to stop. You know, it's a bit like quicksand.
Yeah.
So that was fun and games, but we thoroughly enjoyed it in the end, because we were walking all the way around these absolutely gorgeous locks and seeing some of the most magnificent scenery, and the heather was out, so you had this kind of glorious purple auburn colors on the hills and the highlands, and then these beautiful locks with the water. So it was really superb scenery. And just another excuse to go back and do some more filming.
Exactly. Now, do you feel you captured it?
I think so. I think that you can only capture so much when you're filming, and the other thing is that sadly you can never dictate. And I say sadly, sometimes it's good. You can't dictate the weather.
Right.
And
especially there.
Unlike some film producers who have the luxury of being able to go and sit and wait for the perfect weather condition to get the perfect shot. I don't have that luxury.
Right.
I'm there, and I've got my filming to do today in this location, and I'm somewhere else the next day. So I just have to go for it.
You've got your crew.
You've
got your crew and everybody there.
That's
you need
right.
to do it.
But when you do that, you know something? Sometimes you actually end up getting more interesting shots.
Yep.
Because if it's raining, you go for it. And
yep.
I always say that when people are traveling, they are in exactly the same position. If they happen to be in Devon, they may be standing on an absolutely magnificent beach with the waves pounding through and the boys out on their surfboards, etc., and the kite surfing that they're doing these days. But it might be pouring with rain. And
that's
you've
exactly
got to be
right.
able to find some pleasure in that. Somehow
right.
you can't just sort of say, oh, gosh, it's raining. Let's go back to our bed and breakfast and, you know,
right.
bury our heads and that be it.
Not every day is an ideal situation.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
you might as well, you know, that's the realism of it all.
Absolutely. And we've talked often about tips in the past, and I want to give you two really good ones. I know we've talked about this one before, but I must tell you, on this occasion, I took one of those four-day flexi pass, Brit Rail passes, and you can use it in 2 months or whatever, but the thing is that you're not just using one train service. It actually comprises of different train organizations. And I think I saved probably 70%. I think it actually ended up that I was only paying about 30% of what I would have cost me if I'd bought every single rail fare individually when I was there. By going the long treks, you know, if you're going from Devon to Scotland or to Crewe or somewhere like that, I worked it out that it saved me something like 70%. So I really do urge people to take advantage of things like Brit Rail passes and heritage passes and things like that. It's a huge saving.
Absolutely. We always
yeah.
recommend Europass for people that are traveling.
That's right, yeah. And the other one that I want to suggest, too, is to people, I don't know whether you're familiar with Zoom Airlines. It's probably one of a group of different airlines now that have sprung up and came out of a sort of a semi-charter kind of concept
right.
With small organizations. But we went with Zoom, and I think Air Transat is very similar. And I think you've got, is it JetBlue in
yes.
the States?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a number of them now, and I heartily recommend, particularly in these days, traveling with them, because you can fly into some of the smaller airports. So instead of having to go into Heathrow or Gatwick, you can go to Cardiff or
right.
Manchester
right.
or Birmingham, Glasgow, and I think that it makes life a lot easier given the lineups and the security and the checks and everything else that you have to go through. So those are two tips, along with staying, of course, at bed and breakfast, which I must say, I think the prices are going up a little bit on those, but and you have to watch it, because when you're buying a bed and breakfast now, it's per person, not per room. So
yeah,
it's a bit of a shock.
I found the UK, especially London, very expensive last time I was over.
Mm-hmm. Well, I made the mistake. I kept looking at the prices and seeing 10 and thinking, oh, $10, and of course it was 10
euro,
pounds, and it wasn't $20.
Right, or pounds, right, exactly.
So that was a bit of a shock. And the other thing is, if you can try and book your B&Bs ahead of time, I had read a guidebook which gave me the information that Oban, which is just off the island of Mull on the mainland, was not considered to be a particularly interesting town.
Right.
And I thought, oh, well, that's grand. We won't have any trouble finding a B&B. Well, it's the main ferry stop, and we were running around town having visions of ourselves sitting in a car park overnight, you know, with a raincoat over our heads or something. But we ended up getting a place, but it was something like £60 for a teensy little room, and I thought, my heavens, I really should have listened to myself. You know, here I am giving advice, and I don't follow
it. Don't take your own. I tend to do that myself.
So book ahead. And actually, I have, in fairness to Oban, I have to say it turned out to be an extremely interesting and very nice town, so we enjoyed it.
Well, you know, you mentioned the Isle of Man, and, you know, the Jersey Islands as well. At one point,
mm-hmm.
Some of the Jersey Islands were a part of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I always found that that was interesting. But
and the Orkneys and the Hebrides. You know, I'd never been up to that part of the country, and I really would like to get up there. I think the scenery is fascinating. And also all those islands off the Highland area of Scotland, some beautiful-looking islands, but just not the time to get out there, although there's a wonderful ferry system, and again, you can get passes for the ferries as well, so
now,
you can actually travel quite extensively. But I didn't do that. I'd like to do that. And sea kayaking, we did a little bit of that this time. That was really interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned that, the hiking, the kayaking, and,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. The question that I have, we're about out of time, but
mm-hmm.
The question I have, I went to your website.
This had the process changed, actually, and it's just coming back into being again. If you go to ontopoftheworld.ca,
right.
Which is what I've referred everything to, I literally just put up information on journeys through the British Isles just the last couple of days, and in fact he's making some changes still to it.
Okay,
there
because
is some information up on it now, and people can refer through to me if they want more information or if they're interested. I think I mentioned to you last time that Reader's Digest has packaged the tapes, the DVDs and VHS, and made them available through their subscription.
Right.
And I've also I'm in a position to offer those if people want copies, so that they can have something in which to start developing their own ideas of travel, because there's so many interesting journeys that we cover, everything from castles and gardens to cruising and golfing to following in the footsteps of horses, etc. So I think that there's a lot there for people, and certainly if we run out of time this time, maybe we'll have a chance to do this again, and we'll catch up and talk some more about Britain.
I certainly hope so. It's a great series, and we highly recommend it to our audience. And once again, the website is ontopoftheworld.ca, just
that
the way
right.
you say it.
That's right. And make sure it's the on top of the world. I get sometimes people put top of the world or on top of
right,
the world.
Right, but it's definitely O-N.
O-N.
Thanks again. Always a pleasure.
It's lovely to talk with you, and I hope your audience has a wonderful time on their travels and keeps that spirit of discovery going. That's the key.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
I'm a traveling man, made a lot of stuff all over the world, and in every port I own a part of at least one love.
And we're back, and we're joined by Mr. Bora Ozkoc, founder of Cultural Folk Tours International, and is a role model in this travel industry. I mean, Bora is a world-renowned teacher of Turkish culture, music, folk dance, and who personally leads many of his company tours. And here to tell us about Cultural Folk Tours is Mr. Bora Ozkoc himself. Welcome to Talking Travel.
Hi, this is Bora.
While those that are listening to this at home and in front of their computers, give us your website so they can go directly to that and they can follow along with us.
Okay, it's www.myfirstandlastname, Bora, B-O-R-A, like the Bora Bora Island.
Right.
And then my last name, O-Z, as in zebra, K-O-K, easy to remember, it's Oz, like the Wizard of Oz, K-O-K, not A, not B, but K-O-K.
And pronounced?
So, BoraOzkoc.com.
Right, okay, that's great. First of all, there was an interesting article that was written on you by Colleen, I believe. And
yes.
She went very, very deep into your background, which is really very interesting because you first of all, you went to school to study architecture, mm-hmm. and after you came out, you got involved in the Turkish culture music and folk
Turkish
dance.
Folk dance music, yep. All over the world and all 50 states here.
And so tell us a bit about that. I guess as a young man, as she said, you never dreamed you'd end up running your own company, especially running tours into Turkey.
Yeah.
And so you did, and so you've gone on for what, some 20 years, I guess.
Really, one thing led to another. And, you know, got to Berkeley on an athletic scholarship. I used to be an Olympic swimmer for.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, in fact,
became an architect. That led me to discovering folk dance and music in Berkeley. Before I knew it, I was teaching California, West Coast, East Coast, the world, 22 countries. And, you know, you get invited to teach culture, music, folk dancing. I played many instruments. To make a long story short, from this involvement of cultural involvement to leading cultural tours of my native country of Turkey, which, as you probably know, is incredibly rich in history.
Absolutely.
And 10,000 years of culture as well.
And we might also mention for our listeners that if they go to our site, ttrn.com, and you click on, in fact, Colleen's article, you can see some fabulous photos of some of the hotels/caves that we're going to chat about down the road, but we encourage you to go to the site and follow us along with the pictures. So anyway, so you got into this. You decided that the best way to introduce the people to the culture is to take them by the hand and take them there yourself and do these tours.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, history and this ruin, that ruin, but of course we do that better than anyone else. Historical sites in Turkey is so incredibly many. But aside from the past, there is a present. People, you know, that come to our tours discover today's Turkey as well, customs, traditions, music, folklore, people of today. And we stop for photo opportunities, visit villages. We have lots of shows, performances, folk dance, whirling dervishes. I can go on and on. So it's studying the past, but living the present as well.
And, of course, one of the highlights is the Cappadocia cave sites.
Well, I'm very proud of that. With the staff, I built it. Actually, what it is Cappadocia is an area like Bryce Canyon, only same kind of formations, only add to it 1,000 churches carved by early Christians in the area, 100 of them, 100 still with frescoes, plus underground cities and the people wandering around, you know, in costumes. So tourists are hanging around, but people are going about their business.
Their day-to-day business, yeah.
And then I took these ancient caves, some of them churches, some of them wineries where they stomp on grapes, etc., and I converted into a not 5 but 6-star hotel with jacuzzi in every room. And I'm so proud of the fact that last year Abercrombie and Kent, world's largest travel agency, picked 100 most boutique hotels of the world and rated my place number 17.
I saw that, and I thought that was absolutely terrific. And the interesting thing about some of these underground caves is that they were carved into rock over 1,000 years ago, and as you say, by early Christians who used them as churches, homes, and even stables.
Yeah, and places to hide from enemies.
Right.
You know, there's no fortress that cannot be conquered, but
right.
These underground fortresses were never conquered.
Now, then an opportunity presented itself, and you purchased a piece of land, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, well, people used to live in these until 20, 30, 40 years ago, and then their lifestyle changed, and they moved on to a better place. So they left it all stay as it was. And I converted them into this 18 suites.
Right.
They're really all different from one another, and it's been written up in 5, 6, 7 already major newspapers, even in Japan, Shimbun something, they had a 5-page article.
And you put,
of course, we stay 3 nights in all of our tours in this facility.
Right. Now, you have fireplaces in there, jacuzzis. And then I understand that you're building an addition on it, another 12
yeah,
rooms.
Yeah, another 12 room should be ready by next October.
Good. Now,
it's really something to behold. People, I cannot say enough about it to describe it. When people live in it, then they say, my God, I'll never forget this place the rest of my life.
And you made an interesting statement. You say that you want your guests to understand not just Turkey's past, but all about the living Turkey, the customs, the traditions, and all the other aspects of your country.
Turks are really totally misunderstood. They are, first of all, a secular country, separation of church and state.
Right.
Turkey, tradition, customs is such that hospitality is very, very important. Yet Turks, together with the rest of the Muslim world, is stereotyped. You know, Turks are related to Japanese, the Hungarians, the Mongolians, the Finns are all blood brothers with the Turks.
Interesting.
Of course, the other Muslim countries are Arabs and Persians and Filipinos, etc. But Turks are Turks, and they live in what is known as, to the Romans, Asia Minor. And it's just a spectacularly beautiful country. It's so unbelievable, so misunderstood that people expect deserts, yet Turkey is 35-36% tree-covered. And like I said, there is by far more Greek and Roman monuments in Turkey than the countries of Greece and Italy, for example.
Right, and,
far,
and
no
you,
comparison.
You also point out that it's a very safe country.
Very, very safe. You know, I would dare say that Turkey is safer than places in Europe or any place here in our USA. A woman can walk alone, midnight, alone in the street and feel safe in Turkey. But unfortunately, these days, so many stereotype and so many people are talking about Muslim this, Muslim that.
Right.
Do you know that actually Muslim, Christian, Christianity and Judaism, they're all the same one monotheistic single God religion. And
right.
They're all affected by each other.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, we've just spent, I've just returned a few weeks ago. We spent 2 weeks in Jordan and went through the desert, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea. And it was an incredible experience, and we found the same thing. The people there were hospitable, and so there is a lot of misinterpretation, but of course, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there in the media, and there are some, unfortunately, some radicals in various countries that, you know, we call
it... Well, the Pope is there right now, and
exactly.
We're happy to welcome him. But, you know, unfortunately, before he became Pope, he suggested that Turks should not ever be part of European Union, which Turkey is, as you know, has been accepted. Then it'll take 10 years or so for them to finalize it. But that is the unfortunate comment that he said, oh, Turks are Muslims, so they shouldn't be part of the European Union.
Part of the EU.
Well, all is forgiven and forgotten in time, I'm sure.
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is that here in the United States, we live in a country that's very secluded from other cultures, and I don't think the majority of people really understand it all. And you know, if you've never spent any time other than a week or two and what you've read about these
we're
countries,
trying, I'm certainly trying in my personal tours or my company tours to erase that misunderstanding and that all aspects of the culture and traditions and history and the food, man. Turkish food is considered one of the three major cuisines of the world.
Absolutely.
The other two being Italian, French, Chinese, and Turkish. People don't realize that Armenian, Greek, Lebanese, Syrian, all of those are listed under Turkish cuisine.
I know, and it's lunchtime, and you're getting me hungry here. Now, let's just go to your... talk about your website, because you're changing it a bit, I understand. And also, just take us through what might be a typical tour. We have a couple of minutes left.
Okay. Well, first of all, our 800 number, which we answer live always,
right,
is 1-800-935-TURK, KURK, which stands for 8875. And then my website, as I said, is Bora Ozkok, BORAOZKOK .com. And finally, the email is tourinfo@ my first and last name, BoraOzkok.com. By the way, again, Bora is just like Bora Bora Island.
Right.
OZ is, remember, from the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And KOK, as I said earlier, not AOK, but KOK.
Right, and it's let me just repeat the 800 number again, if I may. It's 800-935-8875.
Yes.
So now let's just, we've got about a minute left. Walk us through a typical tour, if you will.
Well, there is no typical tour because we are always doing a lot of the spur-of-the-moment things. My guides and myself are instructed to take advantage of any opportunity to meet people, visit villages. We stop for photo opportunities. God knows many, many of them. Also in my Central Asia, the Silk Road tour, we have spectacular pictures, but also great, great history. Turkey has more history than any other country in the world by far. No comparison. Nobody could come close. So we utilize those. We have great hotels, super food, and just wonderful opportunities to meet people and learn about the country present, not just the past.
Very well, very well said. And once again, the 800 number is, the toll-free number is 800-935-8875. Bora, I thank you so much for sharing this with you, with us, and we look forward to maybe having a chat again when you get your site up and updated, and we'll talk about it.
God willing, and then maybe we'll even talk about some of the 15 or so musical instruments that I play.
Exactly, and some more of the food.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Talking Travel, the voice of travel live on the Travel Talk Radio Network and worldwide at TTRN.com. You can find your favorite guest by going to our program schedule icon on the TTRN.com website. So until then, this is Roy Lowy wishing you happy travels.
You've been listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Visit our website at TTRN.com for complete show archives and interviews with guests like Chris Elliott, Peter Greenberg, Bob Fisher, Johnny Jett, and many other great travel professionals. Don't forget to tune in live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern for more Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends.